Mike, here's the thing. I am not kidding when I tell you I've been kind of dreading recording this episode. And that this is really true.
Yep, me too. Because we are talking about one of, I realized last night, probably my top three or four movies of all time, which is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yeah.
I absolutely adore this movie. It is another Edgar Wright movie. Is this our second Edgar Wright movie, right? We did
Shaun of the Dead.
We did Shaun of the Dead, which you didn't like.
Oh, did I not like it? That's correct.
Yeah. So I have been... So here's how I have prepared for this. I am fully prepared for you to tell me you don't like this movie. I will explain why you don't like this movie and then tell you why you're wrong. That's kind of where I'm coming from with this one. And I'm mostly joking about the wrong part because this movie needs explanation to a lot of people for good reason, which we'll probably get into. But my thinking is you'll tell me that you either don't like it or you thought it was mostly okay but confusing. We'll then talk about it. I'll tell you everything I love about it and try and explain to you the things that confused you. So that is my prediction for how this is going
to
go.
I think that is close to accurate.
Okay.
So if I may I give my opening statement like macro level review?
Yes.
It started strong. This is going to sound like I'm going play by play. I'm not. It started strong with the 8-bit Universal logo intro thing.
It's a very strong intro. As a person who saw it at midnight showing in Las Vegas.
You were in Vegas?
I was in Vegas. Just randomly, I was in Vegas.
You just woke up one day.
For my mom's 50th birthday. No, we're going for my mom's birthday. And it starts up. The Universal logo in 8-bit starts playing. And I knew that Edgar Wright had done this justice.
So it starts strong. Then you start seeing all of this little, like, I don't know how to describe it other than flair. And we're going to talk more about it. So if that doesn't make sense, just bear with me for a minute. You see all this flair and you're kind of like, what's going on here? And after a while, I remembered having seen this before. When did you discuss this movie? You discussed it on a podcast previously. Do you recall when that was?
Defocused episode 7, maybe, or something like that, but on the Defocused podcast.
Is that what it was?
I'm in that. Yeah.
Huh. Okay, I thought it was something on Relay, but that's fine. Nope. So I'd watched it for that, so I could... I watched the film so I could listen to that episode and kind of, you know, be there with you and Dan and Joe. And when I watched this the first time, and I can't remember where this was in my personal timeline of Edgar Wright, when I watched this the first time, I thought the movie was dumb. I didn't actively dislike it, but I thought it was dumb. Since then, I have seen Shaun of the Dead, and during the course of this conversation on that movie, you to some degree convinced me that I may have, maybe not that I was wrong, but I took the wrong approach to that movie. But more importantly, since then, I have seen the movie Baby Driver, which is also done by Edgar Wright, and I love that movie. And I think it took me finding a movie of his that I love in order for me to better appreciate what Edgar Wright does. As a result of being explained why I was wrong about Shaun of the Dead, and as a result of having seen Baby Driver a few times now, I understand, but I don't know if I particularly care for the plot of the movie, and we can pull on that thread in a little while if we'd like, but I did enjoy the movie. I found myself laughing more than I remembered laughing the first time I saw it. And I was left with a feeling, well, two feelings. Number one, Edgar Wright really is an extraordinarily creative and skilled director. And I think I've come around on that whole issue now. But secondly, I was left with this tremendous sense of emptiness because... This may not make sense to anyone but me, but I feel like this movie proved to me how much of a travesty it is that Edgar Wright did not direct the film version of Ready Player One, because I think he would have done a phenomenal job with Ready Player One.
Or Ant-Man. Do you know he was supposed? He was signed on to Ant-Man.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, and creative differences pulled him off. And I think the reason he was pitched for Ant-Man is because of Scott Pilgrim, because he took a comic book and so elegantly transferred it to film whilst maintaining a link. So I think when Marvel executives saw this movie, they were probably like, ah, we should have him for something.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that was another thing that struck me about the movie in general, was that there were certain scenes, and the one that jumps out at me the most was when he's sitting, I think it was with Knives. No, maybe it was with, what's the other one's name? Ramona. He was sitting with one of the two of them on a swing set. And it was like mm-hmm. this lonesome swing set in the middle of nothingness. There's snow everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the camera is probably like 20, 30 feet up and offset from the swing set. And the way it was shot, I could picture, having never read the book or graphic novel or comic or whatever it was, I could just picture that frame of the comic looking exactly like it did on film. And that wasn't the only example of this, but it was the most obvious example that I could find, where it just seemed to me like this was ripped right out of the comic. And I mean that in a complimentary way, not in a derogatory way. And so as a examination of what a creative director can do, I thought this was utterly phenomenal. As a movie, I thought it was good. And I thought the plot was really weird and stupid, but perhaps I just don't have the context that you have, and that's why.
The context is the problem. I think that you have a feeling about this movie that the majority of people that have seen this movie feel about the movie, which is like, this is visually interesting and funny in some places, but it's also I don't understand what's going on, and this movie's really weird.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I don't know of any other movie, if one exists, I haven't found it, that so elegantly and incredibly well, unlike my phrasing of this, mirrors the source material.
Like, I could imagine that.
The script is by and large word for word in a lot of places from the script of the comic. There are absolutely countless number of shots that are exactly the same as the panels. All of the flashback sequences where Ramona is talking about her exes, right, when it goes to the flashbacks, mm-hmm. and that they are panels drawn by the artist of the comic. The hair, you know, the Ramona hair, like, do you remember that when he says, do you know this one girl with hair like this?
And the hair that looks like nothing.
That scribble is done by the creator of Scott Pilgrim, Brian Lee O'Malley. Like, all of this stuff, it's so perfectly mirrored. Like, the clothing is the same. Like, they made t-shirts that match the t-shirts that Scott wears in the comic for him to wear here. It is so incredibly well done, including the fact that it looks and plays out like a comic book. Like, the cuts are done really nicely. There's a lot of, like, single camera shots which just look like panels. It is as with all Edgar Wright films, a visual and editing masterpiece. It's even, he even did something which I think is kind of unique to this movie. He doesn't use the typical Edgar Wright editing style of, like, lots of close-ups, lots of speed, and lots of noise. It's in all of his other movies. Like, it's a stamp of his, but he doesn't use that too much here because I don't think it would fit the overall aesthetic of this movie. I mean, there's even stuff like there are these, like, almost like titles of scenes that come up every now and then, like Ramona Come Closer.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of those are either lifted from the book or they're written in the same font that's in the book. Like, this is a incredible adaptation of a source material. So the reason that I unequivocally loved this movie the first time I ever saw it is that I had already read all six volumes of the Scott Pilgrim graphic novel.
Oh, so it was a series of graphic novels.
It is a series. It is a six-book series. Scott Pilgrim, the story of Scott Pilgrim, the graphic novel, the movie, is one of my favorite works of fiction that exists. It's one of my favorite stories that exist. I hold it in the pantheon of favorite stories of mine that includes Hamilton and the balance arc of The Adventure Zone as stories and works of fiction that have left an incredible impact on me. I found Scott Pilgrim basically in the time of my life where I was the exact same age as Scott Pilgrim is in the book, kind of in my like early 20s, late teens, early 20s. So it resonated with me significantly. And I absolutely loved it. I found it at a point where like there was only one more book to go. So I read it and then I waited like a year and then finished it. And it's all so wonderful. I have some questions for you, though, really, to try and pick apart some things. Because I think, really, honestly, the main point of conversation that exists around this movie typically is the differences and opinions between somebody who's read the book and somebody who has not read the book. And kind of how things unfold that way. So, for example, like Adina had seen the movie and didn't like it. And she told me this early on in our relationship, and I urged her to read the comic books, which she did, the graphic novels, and she loved it. And she's seen the movie twice since, and she loves it more every time she sees it, which is like how I am too. Mm-hmm. And this seems to be a pretty common thing. But like, I don't believe that it is the job of any viewer to read a 6-volume graphic novel to truly appreciate a movie, because I do feel on the surface level there are things you can enjoy in this movie, but again, to gain the full understanding of the movie, it requires the knowledge, I think. Edgar Wright did a good job of adapting the story, but they never should have tried to do this in one movie. It should have always been at least 2 movies, and it would have allowed them to tell the story more succinctly. So one thing that I always find so interesting, how familiar are you with Michael Cera and his body of work?
Some. I saw him and loved him in Superbad. What else has he been in? I know he always plays basically the same character. Now, I don't know that that's necessarily his choice, but
this is 100% what I was hoping that you would say. So what do you think of him as Scott Pilgrim?
Oh, and you had me watch Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So what did you think? Did you like of him as Scott Pilgrim? Like, what is your opinion on that casting?
I think that it's perfectly reasonable casting, but I wouldn't say it's outside of his comfort zone. It seems to be more of the same.
Right. So this is the problem. Because so it's everybody that comes to this movie, and this was a real strong criticism of this movie, was, oh, it's just Michael Cera playing Michael Cera again. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, Michael Cera as Scott Pilgrim is one of the best casting decisions I've ever seen, because Scott Pilgrim is Michael Cera. Like, there is no other actor that fits the role more than him. And that's one of the real tragedies of this movie, is that people wrote it off thinking that it was just Michael Cera being Michael Cera again, you know? But he embodies the character. They are one and the same now. Like, it is almost as if Brian Lee O'Malley wrote Scott Pilgrim to be like Michael Cera.
Hmm, interesting.
And so he is the only person that could have played this role. And then if you watch the movie, you see the difference, like why it's not standard Michael Cera, because he's an action star.
Yeah, that did strike me that it looked like, well, either the effects were great or just looked like he really did a good job with acting like an action star.
Yeah, he did a lot of like the sword fighting is him, and some of the basic fighting is him. But kind of every time they go to an overhead shot, it's because they have stunt doubles, you know, that are in doing the fighting. But yeah, you know, the casting for him is so perfect. But in all honesty, every single role in this movie is casted perfectly.
Yeah, like, well, and Aubrey Plaza is playing Aubrey Plaza in a similar way.
Yeah,
I mean, it's delightful, don't get me wrong.
Yes. So there is a bit of that where, like, the casting fits because it's, like, that person's typical role. Mm-hmm. But just, like, I mean, just in general, all of the casting fit all of the roles. And the cast for this movie, you look at it today in 2018, is an incredible selection of actors, because you've got, like, Aubrey Plaza and Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who have gone on to huge heights, right?
In, now, hold on. What
in TV
is,
and movies.
What is Mary Elizabeth Winstead done? Because I didn't recognize her.
She's done a bunch of stuff. Like, she was Bruce Willis's daughter in Live Free and Die Hard.
That movie doesn't exist.
Most notably, recently, she played one of the lead roles in 10 Cloverfield Lane.
I've heard of it, but not seen it. Okay.
She was also in, she was in both of the modern Die Hard movies, Live Free or Die Hard, and what was the other one? Go Ahead and Die Hard. I don't know what it's called,
but
you know what I'm talking about, right? There were two. She was his daughter in both of them. But most recently, her biggest role has been 10 Cloverfield Lane, which was one of these movies that was like, it was a big surprise. It was a big smash, you know, like it actually was and has become a cult classic, even though it's very successful in the box office.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen Wong, who is now playing one of the big roles on Netflix's Glow.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. Anna Kendrick. I mean, she's in so many things now.
Chris Evans.
Jason Schwartzman, he was already pretty big at that point. Yeah, Chris Evans was kind of on his upward trajectory
at this point in his career. Such good Chris Evans, because it is so preposterous and so anti, like, Captain America. Not to say that Chris Evans isn't capable of stretching. I think he is. I think he's a very good actor, actually. But it's hilarious to me how, like, over
you can
the top
see
it is.
How, like, his action hero-iness.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's there. So here's a great thing. Great little factoid about this movie. This movie includes Captain America, Superman, and Captain Marvel.
Oh, yeah, because Brie Larson is going to be Captain Marvel. Is that right?
Yep, and what's his name?
Brandon
Ralph played Superman for a bit. So, like, but just in general, like, Michael Cera, Kieran Culkin, who's a really underrated comedy actor. If anything, he should have changed his name. the list goes on. Like, Mae Whitman, she was in Arrested Development.
Who played Anne
in Arrested Development.
No, who did she play in this, I mean?
Oh, she plays one of the exes.
Oh, okay.
Right, so she plays Roxy.
Mm-hmm.
So the cast is incredible. Just wall to wall is excellent. The music. Oh, the music.
Music is very
so good. The soundtrack as a whole is incredible. It's my favorite movie soundtrack of all time. Both, like, the actual, like, not the score. I love the score. But, like, the kind of the soundtrack they put together. There is a large selection of original songs in this movie. There's a song called Ramona, which is written by Beck. There's a couple of songs written by Beck. Ramona is the song that Scott sings to Ramona, which is just Ramona over and over again. But then, I don't know if you remember this, there's a moment where she leaves him at one point and he's walking home on his own and he's like hits his head against a lamppost.
Yeah.
That is the Beck version of Ramona that's playing.
Oh, I don't think I got that.
That song is one of my favorite songs of all time. It is so tender and beautiful. I really recommend that people listen to the full version. There's an acoustic version. The acoustic version is what Michael Cera sings, but Beck sings that on the album. And then there is the full-length version. A couple of the songs that Sex Bob-omb play, Garbage Truck, is an excellent song. And the actors sing it. They play it and sing it. They learned it.
Yeah, I feel like I heard you talk about this, I guess, on Defocused. And I believe it, but that is surprising, because that is not something you can just... Well, maybe I'm just not artistic enough. But that, like, if I just decided to learn how to play bass, if I'm Michael Cera... I'm sure with enough practice, I could kind of fake it, but I don't know. He, and this is why he's an actor and I'm not, he and everyone else did a really, really great job making me think that they were actually playing their instruments, because it seems like they were.
Yeah. Brie Larson's song, Black Sheep. I think they actually made that into a single, another incredible song. So that's the song that they're playing when the Clash at Demon Head have their secret gig. And that, like, Scott and Ramona are in the audience, and he realizes the vegan boyfriend.
Yep.
Right. That's another song. Again, like, all of these are on the album and, like, in full length. They all learned to play instruments they needed to play. They all recorded the songs. Like, it's part of the overall reason of why I love this movie. It's just like everything about it. The video game references everywhere, including licensed music that I have no idea. Like, they got the Zelda song when, you know, like when he opens like the chests, that's in there. There's a lot of Mario sounds are in there. Sonic sounds are in there. They got Mac startup sounds in this movie and era noises. It is an absolute like wall of references that with time you get more and more of them kind of as you're exposed to more and more popular media. Like, oh God, this movie.
So would you say you like it a little bit?
I love it, man. And I had forgotten how much I love this movie until we were 10 seconds into the movie and, or maybe like a minute or two into the movie, and I noticed something I hadn't noticed before. There was a lot of visual references to X's in this movie. They're everywhere. And the one that I noticed is very early on when Scott is walking with Knives. He's kind of they're like walking around town together. They're walking across the snow, and there's like two paths that intersect into an X.
Oh, interesting. I did not catch that.
And there's other stuff like Scott has an X-Men patch on his jacket. In the comic book is the X-Men logo. In the movie, it's just an X, which is quite funny. It's one thing they couldn't get. The 7X is under the phone number, which is explicitly called out in the movie. There are so many like little visual tricks. Every time he's going to fight an X, the number of which X it is in the line appears everywhere.
I did not notice that either.
It's all over the place. They use the numbers. Like again, these are all these things you spot, right? It is a rich tapestry, this movie. So let me talk about the problem you've had. I know I'm talking the whole time, but I feel like I probably have more to say on this movie anyway.
That's fine, but may I seed this conversation with what I think my problem is, and then here again, yes, you can tell me what it really is. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And again, this isn't your problem.
I know
what I mean. Yeah, like, yeah. What's wrong with you? Sure. It is the problem of this movie.
Yep.
But go ahead.
Absolutely. So I think the problem that I had with it is that I had forgotten that I personally would classify this as like a sci-fi movie, or certainly it is not. To my eyes, it is not from the reality that you and I are sitting in right now. Like, whether it's science fiction or whatever, maybe it's magic, whatever, however you want to slice it, it is just not the reality that you and me live in.
It's a comic book movie.
Sure. And I think the tough thing for me is that, and maybe it's just because I'm not an advanced, movie watcher, but I feel like this went from being a Superbad kind of movie where it's just a movie for like teenagers or young adults just doing teenagery and young adult things. And that's how it starts. And granted, there's some of that like directorial flair, but there's nothing that indicates we're not in reality. And then all of a sudden out of nowhere, and I forget exactly what the first X was or how this evidenced itself, but out of nowhere,
Matthew Patel.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I am Matthew Patel.
All right. And all of a sudden out of nowhere, I've been dropped or torn away from reality and put in a sci-fi movie. And maybe that's deliberate. I don't know. But it was very abrupt, and it was hard for me to shake my preconception. And maybe that's the problem, was that it was a preconception. But it was hard for me to shake my preconception that this is a movie set in reality, when it is so clearly not. It is so clearly not set in reality. But that's the way, that's the like the mental model I had of it when I came to the movie. And it was hard to shake that, even during all these ridiculous fight scenes and everything else, which I enjoyed. I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it, but it felt like it wasn't genuine. And that sounds more negative than I mean it, but it felt like something just changed all of a sudden and I didn't get eased into it. Does that make any sense at all?
It makes complete sense. So there is, you know, obviously I think part of the reason it's done that way is the shock value, but they could have done a better job of setting things up to you, and they attempt to do it, but they don't give enough explanation. So they try and establish the hyper reality of this movie very early on, with the moment where, so they've, the Knives and Scott are on their date, they're doing the rhythm game, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it cuts to a moment where I think Scott is in like a desert and Ramona rollerblades past him. Later on, this is shown again. There's another moment like this again, which is followed up by Scott waking up, which is, they're in like a school.
Right? Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. It's like walking through lockers in a school. That's when the Zelda music's playing, and she's rollerblading through again. So I'm going to tell you what's happening here, and you would never believe it because the movie doesn't do a good enough job of explaining it. Ramona has the access to some kind of ability to use Scott's dreams as a way to pass through physical space, which enables her to be a better delivery person.
They did make brief reference to that.
They touch on it, but it doesn't make any sense when you see it, and the reference to it is so quick and brief. She calls it like a thingy, right? A hyperdimensional doorway, and they go through the doorway. This is an incredibly important part of the book, but it is only used in like the first 20 minutes of this movie, and then at the very, very end. I think that that part should not have been there at all, and they should have used that time to establish the hyperreality of the movie in different ways, because they do not use this as a plot device like it is used in the book. Mm-hmm. Like, a big part of the resolution of the story in the book is the use of the portals. That's what they end up using to ultimately save the day. And that's not done here. So I really wish that they would have found a way to either establish Ramona's like hyperreal powers in different ways that also lent itself into setting up that there was going to be some weird stuff going down. Because the other thing is, like, that thing, the doorways and the pathways, that confuses people because it doesn't make sense. It is like very loosely explained in the comic, but it happens enough that you come to
it's just part of that world.
It's part of the world, and it's not emphasized strongly enough in the movie. I really wish that they would have changed it, especially because they could have done a better job of setting stuff up and stretching some other things out later on. Like, they really rapid fire move through some of the X's, and it could have been more interesting to see things done slightly differently. There is a big change, though. The ending to this movie is almost wholly original. The way this movie ends is not the way the book ends. The book's ending is significantly more complicated. I actually prefer the movie's ending to the story. A couple of the things that I like about it is that Knives plays a really important role in the ending and gets a real significant closure to her relationship with Scott, which is achieved, I think, in a slightly different way in the book. And I like the way that they have Scott kind of standing up for himself and facing himself and his own insecurities as the way to end it. It is like this insane fight with like time bending and hyper dimensions, and Scott dies in this movie and he dies in the book, but it's more significant, right? That's when he gets a life, you know, he has the one up, so like he comes back to life and gets the second go around. And then also the way that it ends with like him choosing to go off of her, like, I like the way the movie ends a lot. I actually prefer, again, like, I've only read the book's ending like 1.5 times because it is really confusing. But the ending to the movie is my preferred ending to the story. But the doors and the dream portals, I think, are the things that are like the hardest to grasp for people unfamiliar with the comic. And I really wish that they would have used that time a little bit differently to establish the comic bookiness of the action that was going to occur.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how they would have done that. And maybe they tried to. And it ended up, they decided that the best way to try and do it was to show the portals. But I don't think that it ultimately achieved what they were trying to do.
I completely agree. Having never read the books, it just seemed weird to me and just like an aside, and I didn't I didn't grasp the gravity of it, if you will. But as you were talking about the end fight, I skipped forward in my copy to kind of have that playing in the background as I'm listening to you, and I'm reminded that it's hard for me to verbalize this, but this movie is visually so over the top and so heavily edited, and there's so many effects, be it practical or you know, CGI or whatever, it doesn't matter. There's so much going on, and it's so visually loud. And in so many ways, I feel like I should be turned off by it, But I actually think it is so well and tastefully done, despite the fact that it's somewhat over the top. It's over the top because it needs to be. And it's so, so, so well done. And I think it's because of that, that because Edgar Wright was able to straddle the line between going too far and not enough. It's because of that, that I wish so badly that he had gotten Ready Player One rather than Steven Spielberg. And if you've seen Ready Player One, or if you haven't, and I'm talking both to you, Mike, and the listeners, suffice to say, it was a good movie, I thought, but I loved the book, and I don't think the movie handled the book as well as I would have liked, which is not an unusual, you know, perspective to have. But
that's always a fear if you love a book. I mean, that was my fear going into this movie, and like it's one of the reasons I love this movie so much is because Edgar Wright treats it so fairly.
Exactly. It was a faithful reproduction, as I think you had said earlier. And I thought Ready Player One tried very hard to be faithful, but I don't think it ultimately achieved it. I think just the feeling of the movie was different. And from what you're telling me, the feeling of Scott Pilgrim versus the World is the same, even if the particulars are a little bit different. And that's what makes it so great. And so I wish that Edgar Wright had Ready Player One, because it feels like it's certainly different than this movie, but it's of a similar spirit. And I think he would have done such a phenomenal job with it.
Talking about practical effects, there is one little thing that I really love. Do you remember when he orders the Amazon package and he's waiting for Ramona to come and she brings it and he signs for it and throws it over his shoulder and it goes in the trash can?
I remember him signing for it. I don't remember it landing in the trash, but go ahead.
He throws it over his shoulder and it lands in the trash can. That is real.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of my knowledge of the movie comes from the very excellent Blu-ray special features, which are not part of the iTunes download, which makes me so sad. I don't know if there is a version where you can get them, but the special features for this movie, if you are a fan of this movie, are so good. Like all of Edgar Wright's special features on all of his movies are very, very good. And I think it's because he knows he makes cult movies. So they do a lot of special features for those, right? But there's like one section of the special features, which is purely all of the attempts sped up.
Oh, no.
Of Michael Cera just throwing, it is a far, it's not close, right? Like he has to keeps chucking, and eventually gets it in. So, you know, I don't really have a ton more to say about this movie. Like, I wish that people would see it if they haven't seen it, even if they've listened to this. I would hope that maybe if you've listened to this and haven't seen it or haven't read the books, I might be able to set you up in such a way that you might enjoy it more. You know, like, again, like, you know, I have a tattoo. I have two more tattoos planned in my life, and one of them is the Scott Pilgrim tattoo. I'm going to get the girl with the hair like this.
I had thought that you had told me that, because when I saw it, and it's kind of ruining the joke, but suffice to say, it's just a freaking scribble. Like, it is completely unintelligible, and he says to, I forget who it is, have you ever seen a girl with hair like this? And he holds up, like, a full-size sheet of paper with just scribbles on it. It doesn't even look like a human head, if you ask me. And the person, whoever it was it Aubrey Plaza? Was like, oh, yeah, no, that's
It's this guy called Comeo.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Anyway, he's like, oh, yeah, that's Ramona Flowers. She's probably over there or something like that. It's so hilarious because it's a completely unintelligible just series of scribbles.
Right, but like the idea is this guy knows everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So you're thinking about getting that tattoo?
Oh, it's always been my tattoo, right? I've always had the idea of getting the tattoo.
And, I remember us talking about this forever ago. Privately.
This was my first ever tattoo idea, but then I had a couple of things that was more symbolic in my life of actual events, or like things rather than just things that I love. But yeah, I will get this tattoo at some point. I just haven't gotten it yet. So I absolutely adore this movie. I really wish that people will watch this movie because it's wonderful. But more, you know, I would say, like, if you have the inclination, also read the books, because the Scott Pilgrim story is sublime. It was originally in a black and white this black and white style, like almost close to manga in its presentation, especially in like book size. A few years ago, they brought out color versions, so you can get color versions. And I actually found out yesterday, whilst kind of just like poking around, the next year is 15. It's the 15-year anniversary of the story of the first book. So they're bringing out new color versions, which I have now pre-ordered, which will mean I will own the entire series three times. I own actually a lot of it four times. I think I'm going to own it. This will be my fourth copy of every book. I own the regular version. I own the there are two versions of hardcover color that I own each of. There is a Scott version and an Evil X's version, because the Evil X's version came as this like super pack, which came with all this memorabilia. So I have like coins and patches and drumsticks, and like they Oni Press, the company that kind of owns the rights to the book, they created these like mega fan packs, and I bought them all. I actually have a letter opener, which is the sword that he gets that comes out of his chest.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of Scott Pilgrim memorabilia because, you know, it is like my favorite, one of my favorite fictional properties of all time. So there you go. I absolutely love this movie. I'm pleased that you feel about this movie as I expected you would. You don't hate it. You enjoyed it, but it was confusing, because that's how most people are. And as long as you felt that way, then I'm happy.
Good. No, I did enjoy it. I definitely enjoyed it. And again, this is the second time I've seen it. The first time I actively disliked it, if I remember correctly. And this time I enjoyed it. I would say I liked it.
You've
I didn't
grown.
Love it, but
you've grown as a person. You know,
that's got to be it.
But you know what makes me even happier than your appreciation for the movie?
That I sort of am starting to appreciate Edgar Wright?
Nope. All Relay FM members.
Oh, I should have known. You know, I appreciate them too.
Thank you so much for being a member of Relay FM. We really appreciate it. We hope that you have enjoyed our contribution to the bonus episodes for this year. And we, in case you don't know, me and Casey produce a show called Analog every 2 weeks, where we just talk about things that are happening in our lives centered around the way that we deal with the internet and technology. If you've never listened to the show and you've gotten this far, you can probably handle me and Casey talking. We argue a lot on the show, which makes it interesting to listen to, I think. So we Casey and myself, we do not hold back to debate. And I think that makes the show infinitely more interesting than maybe some of the other shows that you may have found in your podcast player. Thank you so much for being a member of Relay FM, and we'll do this again next year, I guess.
Yep. Do I get to choose next year, or is it always going to be Casey at the cinema?
I think next year we should probably do Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, you're probably right. All right, I'm going to have to start stealing myself now and preparing myself, but it's likely that it'll go a lot better.
Have you not seen Hot Fuzz?
I think I might have once. Is that the one with the cops in the middle of nowhere and the zombies?
Yes.
No. Yes.
No, there's no zombies.
That's the Shaun of the Dead.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I have seen Hot Fuzz once, and I don't remember caring for it very much at all. But again, I'm a reformed individual now, so there's a chance. There's a chance. We'll see. Anyway, thank you to Relay members. Double thank you to those of you who are members of Analog, which is a program that Mike and I create, like he mm-hmm. said. But no matter what, thank you, and we'll talk to you in a year, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bye.